Thanks. So this is the title, Machine Learning for Lattice Field Theory and Back. So my background actually is in lattice field theory, in so QCD, quantum chromodynamics, but always in problems which are not easily solvable. So Sebastian mentioned Langevin dynamics. I worked for quite a while on complex Langevin dynamics to solve the sine problem, and also inverse problems in spectral functions. So I'm always interested in things which are slightly, you know, not straightforward, where you not simply just push the button and you'll get the answer, you know, half a year later sometimes in this field, but sometimes where you have to think a little bit about what is possible. And so machine learning obviously is an interesting area with lots of activities. And, you know, it came on my radar a few years ago, partly the paper by Roger, for instance. And so we had one student working on this who graduated last year, and now we're working with Chan Yu, continuing that work. And so I just, I'm learning a lot basically in this field. I like to show this, the next slide, because I think it's interesting. So machine learning has been around obviously for a very long time. But if you look in particle physics, which is my area of research, then you can go to Inspire, which is the database for all particle physics, high energy physics papers. And if you just very simply type in Inspire, find title learning, you find a nice graph that looks here, and it looks like, oh my God, there's an exponential increase in the number of papers in this topic. And indeed, if you then take the data and you put them on a log scale, there's indeed exponential growth. So it's definitely a popular a popular area in the high energy physics community as well, with you know, 1,000 papers written last year which had had learning in the title. Whether this is an indication of a, you know, whether it will go down, we have to wait a few more years. So in the talk, I'll give an overview of the work that we have been doing and are currently doing. The first one is very much, you know, I would say by now classic application, which started in on your site actually. But we have maybe something new to add here. So this might be of interest. And then I'll talk about the two topics which are more new and more new concepts appear, so to say. One is the inverse renormalization group that Sebastian already mentioned. And then second part of the talk about something we call quantum field theoretical machine learning. But basically, we'd like to use our understanding of lattice field theory to, you know, provide some input into machine learning and maybe learn something that is useful for both areas. So useful for us to apply machine learning techniques in lattice field theory and vice versa, using the methods that we're very familiar with in lattice field theory to maybe shed some light on things that happen in machine learning. And of course, the talk is clearly biased towards my own work and my own interests. And this is really because of a lack of knowledge of the wider machine learning literature, which I'm, you know, not fully aware of, obviously. So the first talk, and please also interrupt me when you have any questions. There's no need to wait till the very end. So the first topic is the specification. So these are actually the papers. So the first papers are written with Dimitrios, who was a student, and my colleague Biagio Lucini. And then the renormalization group, inverse renormalization group, is in this paper. And in the end, I'll talk about the things we're currently working on with Chan Yu and Biagio. So the first topic is very well known to most of you, I'm sure. This is to classify phases of matter using machine learning. This paper here is, of course, a well-known paper. But I want to show a little bit that what we've done, which maybe which you may not have seen, which goes a little bit further maybe than the applications that exist. Of course, so the big picture is very clear. We want to identify phases. Machine learning is very good at pattern recognition. And so there's clearly an ordered phase here and a disordered phase here. And so what happens in the middle is the question. And we'll apply it first to the easing model. Like the whole world obviously applies this to the easing model. So, but the point of this slide is, of course, that the easing model is extremely well known. It's solvable in two dimensions. We know the critical exponents that exist. We know the critical coupling, and we know finite size scaling. And we really want to use these, extract these, say, critical components and coupling using machine learning techniques, and also use finite size scaling to do so. So we want to make a high precision calculation, so to say, and use the standard techniques that we know from critical phenomena and that's been used in statistical physics for a long time, but apply them in the context of the machine learning approach to this problem. So here's an example of plots you probably have seen. So two-dimensional easing model has a critical coupling at about a critical inverse temperature at about 0.44. And so on the left here, we're in the in the ordered phase. Let me think now, I have to get it right. In the disordered phase, and on the right in the ordered phase. And this plot has been created, roughly speaking, in as follows. So we train a neural network like the one up here at very small values of betas and very large values of betas. In fact, beta values which are not even on this plot. So further to the left and further to the right. And then extract this probability to be in the broken phase on the left or the symmetric phase on the right. And this is indicated with the symbols and the line. Now, I'll say a little bit more about the symbols and the line here, because on the next slide, because they're in fact quite non-trivial. But the statement, of course, is that this probability kind of approximately behaves as an order parameter. And so we can extract some maybe critical couplings from here. Of course, there are finite size effects. So if you do this on different volumes, so 128 squared up to 760 squared, the transition gets sharper and this line increases, you know, the slope of this line increases. Now, there are lots of papers that simply say, well, let's extract the critical coupling to see where this function is equal to a half, so between 0 and 1. And we simply say the half is where the transition takes place. But this is, of course, a little bit simplistic in a way, because if we think about this, you know, the finite size scaling and the critical properties of the transition, we could do a better job than simply looking at these some value in the middle here. And so that's what we want to do. We want to extract from these curves more than a kind of approximate value of the critical coupling, but do a proper statistical mechanics analysis, really. And so that's what we do. That's what we did in this paper. And so the question is here, what is, you know, this approach I just sketched is well established, has been tried, applied to many theories, especially spin models, POTS models, models with continuous symmetries. But so what can we add to this? And so what we would like to think about, we'd like to think about it in this way, namely you create a whole bunch of configurations with approach. So these are sampled from according to a Boltzmann distribution with a certain temperature. And if you have a whole bunch of configurations and you measure something on this ensemble, you are computing an observable. And so suppose you measure the magnetization, very hands down, you define it as a sum over the magnetization on each configuration averaged over all configurations. And that gives you a physical observable, which is the magnetization. Now here we do, in a way, we do something similar, except it's much more convoluted and complicated or not so clear. We take a whole ensemble of configurations at a given temperature. We do something with it, namely we put it through this trained neural network, and out comes a number between 0 and 1 to be, say, in the broken or the symmetric phase. And so we can think of this output number here, not as simply the prediction of the neural net, but we can actually think of it as a physical observable, which is constructed in a kind of complicated way, but actually in the same way in which you compute the magnetization or the susceptibility or any physical quantity, namely as an average over configurations that are put into this machine, so to say. And so, in other words, we can interpret the outcome of a neural network, in this case, as a physical observable, which is essentially taken as a sum over configurations, which are weighted with the Boltzmann weight in the correct way. And so this is how we want to think of this. Now, why is this useful to think about an output of a neural network as a physical observable in a kind of statistical physics sense or computational physics sense? Because then we can do all the techniques that we know from statistical physics, and especially, say, computational statistical physics. And so, in other words, we can use standard numerical methods or statistical methods to further massage the outputs of the neural network. And so one thing we could do, for instance, is we can do histogram reweighting, which is a very standard approach to get results not only at the coupling constant at which you have created the configuration, say at a fixed beta, but also to extrapolate to other parameter values, so different values of beta. And so this is what is shown in this plot here, in this equation on the left here. So we put configurations here on the left, which are created at a fixed value of beta zero through the neural network. We get a prediction for the probability to be in the broken phase, say. And then we can extrapolate this particular probability to beta values in the neighborhood of beta zero via this histogram reweighting, single histogram reweighting. And this is actually how this plot on the right was created. So this is not creating many configurations at many different beta values and feeding them through the trained neural net to kind of determine this decision boundary, this function. But instead, only the black diamond here actually has been put through the neural network. So this is the beta zero value down here. And then the whole line that is shown has been obtained by reweighting from beta zero and extrapolating to in beta on either side. And that gives the line here. And so the line obviously interpolates from zero to one, all based on this one single point as an input point here. The open diamonds are shown because these are essentially a cross-check. Namely, of course, we create more configurations at different beta values, namely at the open diamonds, and also find out what the probability is to be in the broken phase for those configurations. And of course, lo and behold, the line goes through these open diamonds here. And so there's two things to learn here, namely that the neural network has been trained properly in the sense, so we get this nice crossover behavior. But second, that histogram reweighting actually works, because if I extrapolate from the black diamond in both directions, I go through the open diamonds. So this is a way to get a continuous curve from very little input into the algorithm. So having done this, we can also, so if you really think of this P now, this probability as a physical quantity, we can look not only at the expectation value of P, but we can also look at the susceptibility, so the fluctuations in P. And that should give something that looks like a function with a peak. And in the infinite volume limit, the peak should diverge depending on the order of the phase transition and so on. And so this is now really using kind of what you would call standard critical behavior and finite size scaling critical theories, but using not a standard magnetization or susceptibility, but using the probability produced by the neural network and its related susceptibility as the observables. And so that's shown here. This is the fluctuations in this probability. And indeed, this peaks, and at the largest volume, the peak is more pronounced. The peak slowly moves to the right as you increase the volume. And if you take these values and put them as a function of 1 over L, where L is the linear dimension, then you find this nice line here, which can be fitted. And in fact, so here you can use standard finite size scaling. And so this line is fitted with a finite size ansatz, like one shown here in the beginning here. And so you can extract the critical coupling in the infinite volume limit and also the critical exponents related to these quantities. And so the results are shown in the bottom here. So using only the output from the neural network and interpreting as a physical quantity, which we can then use further down, we find a prediction for the critical coupling and also for the two critical exponents here, which are essentially in agreement with the expectation from the exact solution, obviously. So this is quite nice because this goes, in a way it goes beyond many kind of standard applications, because we really use finite size scaling to get a high precision outcome for the phase transition. It works not only in the easing model. Here is the another example in a scalar field theory, phi 2 to the 4 scalar field theory in two dimensions. Actually, this plot appears in a different paper on transfer learning, essentially, because here we used a neural network trained on the easing data and then instead gave it phi to the 4 data to essentially determine where, roughly in what area of parameter space, the phase transition happens. And once that region has been identified, so there's a symmetry broken phase here for negative mu squared and a symmetric phase for a slightly smaller negative mu squared. Once we use the easing trained neural net to find this region, we can then retrain the neural network in the regions away from the transition, so on the left of here and to the right of here, and then predict again what happens in the middle. And so the rest of this analysis is the same as in the easing model. The line has been obtained with the histogram reweighting, or in this case, the reweighting is in mu squared. And then doing finite size scaling on different volumes, we get a prediction here for the critical mass parameter in this case. So this is phi to the fourth theory with a fixed quartic coupling, but with a, so everything is a function of the mass parameter.
Can I ask a question?
Mm-hmm.
So, Roger, don't get mad at me that I'm asking this, but phi to the four, the scalar field theory is the same universality class as the Ising model, right? Is that the intuition behind why this transfer learning works so well in this case?
That's a good question.
I was literally just with her, and he's like, does she exist anymore in this show? I'm like, I was with her an hour ago.
It's almost like there are two conversations happening at once, but I understood the question, I think. So the transfer learning is actually, I removed these slides because of lack of time, because we've also done this in the POTS model with Q, so the Q stage POTS model, where for larger Q, the transition is first order and transfer learning still works, actually. So it seems to be more looking at the behavior of ordered versus disordered, rather than specific properties of the phase transition in terms of the universality class. I removed that slide as well. You can look at the activation functions in the first layer, and you can see that there are the activation functions are differently activated depending on whether you're in the ordered or the disordered phase. So that seems to be the important feature that tells you which phase you're in.
And
the
disordered.
You can go ahead. I was just gonna say that's super interesting.
And actually, the order of the phase transition, to really determine that, you have to do this finite size scaling analysis, because you have to know which quantity diverges with volume when you take the infinite volume limit. So that goes back to the more traditional method of analyzing phase transitions. But as you rightly say, this one is in the same universality class, and so you can fit this the line, do the same finite size scaling, and you will need to find the same critical exponents as in the easing case. Interestingly, here the critical mass parameter is not known analytically. And so this is the prediction, which is quite well, quite precise. And luckily it agrees with the critical mass obtained with other methods, like looking at Binder Cumulants or susceptibilities. So it works, so to say. But that's the so this is our, in a way, tiny contribution to this field, which is quite interesting, I would say. So, but the proposal we made is to to think a little bit more about the outputs of a neural network and actually interpret them as observables in statistical physics, which means that you can then use the whole machinery of statistical physics and computational physics to analyze them using histogram reweighting and do finite size scaling and so on, and get, you know, very precise results from quantities that are derived from neural networks alone. Okay, so I'll go to the next topic now. So if there's still questions on this topic, I'll wait. Great. So the next topic is on the renormalization group, and in fact, on the inverse renormalization group. And so again, this is, of course, a standard technique in statistical physics. And the renormalization group goes back to Wilson and Kadanoff. You have configurations which are not at a critical point, and then you can do some coarse graining or a blocking transformation or integrating out degrees of freedom in order to study the critical theory. And the simplest approach is the Ising model and Kadanoff block spin. So I have a system here of linear size L, and I say I can take a block of 4x4 spins and simply apply the majority rule. If 4 or 3 spins are black, I'm going to replace it with the standard, you know, with one spin, which is black. If 3 are white, I replace it with white. And if it's equal 2 and 2, then I can flip a coin to decide how to replace this spin.
Now, Kurt, I think we have a question from the big room here.
I see this. I see in chat something. Yeah. Can I ask a question? Yeah.
I'm sorry if you speak.
There's a lot of echo, but you can type it, or you can switch off the speaker on your phone, maybe.
Sorry. So you were talking about in the 2D Ising model, you found the critical temperature, the critical beta, and it was, I think it was accurate within 3 decimal places in the 2D Ising model. Yes. And what my question is, because your diagrams seem to be very sparse, and but you seem to be saying, and also you have the scaling problem so that your lattices are finite size. How do you get accuracy within 3 decimal places, even though I didn't expect you to get 2 point, like for the temperature to get 2.269, but you seem to have been gotten that.
Yeah. So I would phrase it as accuracy, as agreement within the error, I would say, because there is an uncertainty here. And I don't know what you exactly mean by sparse. You mean the number of volumes that are present?
Ali, I don't know if you're responding or if you intend to be muted.
Okay, I'll continue. Anyhow, the point is that of all these volumes, they all contribute to determining this line, to fitting this line. And so, and since these have relatively small errors, you can fit this line quite precisely, basically. That's the answer. So as long as you have enough points with a finite volume, you can do a pretty accurate fit to reach the infinite volume result. And that's, of course, the power of finite size scaling. We'll take it as an acceptance. Okay, so let's go to the rooms. But if you have more, there's something in chat now. How's it going? Okay, so basically, finite size scaling allows you to extrapolate to the infinite volume limit with only limited data on a finite volume. Yeah. Okay, so the standard renormalization group is about reducing the number of degrees of freedom, and this allows you to do critical scaling and of course leads to the whole machinery of the Wilsonian renormalization group and critical exponents and so on and so forth. And of course, the standard notion of this is that it's not a group in the traditional sense or in mathematical sense, but it's essentially a semi-group, because I start with, say, in this case, 16 degrees of freedom, and I end up with 4, and I can't revert it because there's no one-to-one mapping between the lattice on the right and the lattice on the left. And so I'm losing information, but it's exactly the point of the realization group, of course. I'm integrating out dynamics at small degrees of freedom, the dynamics at small scales, to focus on the large-scale behavior. So what an RG also does, of course, it generates the flow in parameter space, and you will find the relevant directions. This will teach you more about the system. Very operationally, of course, if I do this Cardanov blocking repeatedly, at some point I will run out of degrees of freedom because I'm combining 4 spins in one. And so if I start with 16 spins, the next step I only have 4, and I would only be able to do one more step of blocking, and I would have only 1 spin left. And so I can't do this over and over again. I would need to start with a very large system to apply the RG multiple times. But of course, it's difficult to create large systems, especially close to a transition, because of critical slowing down. So this is, these problems are very well known. They are old problems, so to say. They're just a feature of the blocking procedure, or the RG procedure. And so the question you could ask is, what if we could invert the renormalization group, in the sense that instead of integrating out degrees of freedom, we're actually adding degrees of freedom to the system? And so instead of coarse graining, instead we're actually filling in the details. In other words, we're filling in the spins between the spins we have to get richer configurations. If you could do this and this is like what's shown in the plot here. Suppose I start with a configuration of linear size L0, and I then double the number of degrees of freedom in a way that will come on the next few slides, I get a larger system, and I get a larger system. And so instead of going from the right to left where I'm integrating out, I'm integrating up here, or integrating in here, and get more and more lattice points. In the way that if you go from larger systems to smaller systems, or from if you integrate out degrees of freedom, you create a flow in parameter space. In this case, if you go in the opposite direction, you generate an inverse flow in parameter space. And so your flow equations in principle are still valid, except that you're flowing in the opposite direction. And practically speaking, of course, you can do this an arbitrary number of times because you're not running out of spins to coarse grain, so to say. And also you're integrating a larger and larger lattice, which is in fact closer to criticality because of the inverse flow. And so you evade critical slowing down. Now, this idea is in fact not new. It was already proposed 20 years ago or so for the easing model. So this paper, Inverse Monte Carlo Realization Group Transformation for Critical Phenomena by Svensson and collaborators. But we applied this now to a continuous field theory. So again, to 5^4 and 2 dimensions, and using some notion from machine learning, really. So that's shown here. So we have to find a transformation that does an inverse renormalization group, and so that adds degrees of freedom rather than removes them. And this we do by learning essentially how to do that by doing one RG step in one direction, and then learning the inverse step in the other direction, and comparing the outcomes to tune the parameters in the step. So suppose that the graph on the left, the configuration on the left, is say from a 32x32 system. We do one RG step to get a 16x16 system. And then we want to learn this TC, which stands for transpose convolution, to go back to a 32x32 system. And then we can compare the plot on the right, the configuration on the right, with the configuration on the left, and see how well we do, and simply minimize the difference between those two. Now, there's not necessarily a unique way to do so, but we can essentially find parameters in the transpose convolution that minimize this difference and use that to work with. And so a transpose convolution is essentially like a convolution, but in the other direction. Normally you would take in this plot here the bottom layer as your image, and then have a filter sliding over the image, which gives you an image in the next layer, say, which is reduced in size. In the inverse proposal that we're using here, we actually start with the layer on the top, which is smaller in size, say 16 by 16, and then learn the parameters in the convolution to blow up the system to a bigger system by comparing the output with the original input before doing the RG step. And so we go from a smaller configuration to a larger configuration by comparing this one with what we know was the original before doing the RG step here. What's important now to apply this further on is that this transformation here, this choice of filter and of parameters in the filter, is a local transformation, which means that we can keep on doing this because we're just locally blowing up the degrees of freedom. And so we can do it iteratively, and in this way create larger systems and generate a flow and parameter space, as I mentioned. And eventually when the system, and so the flow actually takes you towards the critical point. And so in the end, you'll have you create configurations which are essentially at the critical point and are scale invariant. So here again is the application and the 5^4 theory. And so by looking at the scaling of, so by looking at the magnetization and the way it scales, you can see that it's flowing towards a critical point. In this particular plot, actually, we use, say, L is a system directly generated on a size of 64 squared, but L prime is obtained from 32 squared, and then applying the inverse renormalization group. And because you are flowing towards the critical point, the magnetization, if you are in the broken phase, is reduced, and if you're in the unbroken phase, is increased. So this, so what you can see from these plots actually is that you're flowing in the correct direction. So you're flowing towards the critical point if you do one of these inverse renormalization group steps. You don't actually need to compare with the same system on the same lattice size to do this, because that would be the whole purpose, because that means you still have to create configurations on these large lattices. But in fact, you can just focus on the system that's obtained by iteratively applying the inverse renormalization group. And that's what's shown in the table here. So in this case, only configurations have been created at linear size 32 only. And then you can repeatedly apply this transformation over and over again. And so go from 32 to 64 to 128 to 56, 512. And you can do it in various combinations. And by looking at the scaling of the magnetization in these different volumes, you actually immediately have access to the critical exponents in the theory. And so, and these critical exponents converge again to the answers we know, 7/8 and 1/8. But everything is created from one set of configurations on the smallest lattice only. So it's start with a lattice of 32 squared, apply these steps, float, create larger lattices, and then flow towards the critical point. And so here these critical exponents are plotted. Of course, the errors and so on are highly correlated because everything is created from this initial point at the start here, but it flows towards the expected critical exponent at the largest lattices here. And so not only do we get the critical exponent, but of course, in the end, you also have a lattice of 512 squared, which is very close to criticality and which has been created without critical slowing down. So this is an area to explore more, namely what to do, to do physics with these lattices then. So let me summarize this and then wait for questions. So basically, this inverse RG allows you to flow towards a critical point without critical slowing down and reach large lattices. The tricky thing actually is to find a reliable blocking step. So it looks like in this plot, it looks like the tricky thing is to go from here to here, which is partially true because this is the kind of the machine learning stage. But what was also not tricky, but you know, you have to spend some time on it, is to find a good RG step. For spins, in the easing model, is obviously the majority rule works extremely well. In scalar fields, you have to think a little bit, because the field values can take any value between plus and minus infinity. So if you do something which is not exactly right, you get very large values, because you add everything up and everything becomes very large. So this step, you have to make sure that this step here is a proper RG step. And after that, you can learn the inverse transformation, basically. So that's the statement here about the scalar field majority rule, which has to be tested really well to ensure it creates an RG. Okay, so I'll stop here just for questions about this bit.
Okay, let's thank Gert for this very nice talk.
Wait.
He's only, only half done, aren't you?
Oh, you're half done. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, it's only intermediate. Yeah, yeah. No, I do just questions.
I do have a question here. So, was that Skylar?
Yeah, I was going to ask a question really quick. My question was about, you said it depends on like the lattice size that you start with. So can you see any signatures of like that initial starting point, like there, you know, that carries through in your convergence at larger system sizes?
Yeah, so let me say it a little bit better then. The errors here are highly correlated with the initial error, because they all come from the same starting point, but the value does not actually. So we've done this with initial lattice size 32, but also with initial lattice size 16, for instance. And then it doesn't, you know, the result doesn't depend on that. But, you know, the obvious question is here that all the error bars have the same size. And that's what I was referring to, because these are not independent error bars. Yeah.
Can I also ask a question? So I was wondering, when you do the inverse RG steps, and I mean, it might not be a problem in the 5-2-4 theory, but in the Ising model, what guarantees you that your outputs are proper spin variables, or is it like a probabilistic output, and then you sample from it a spin variable instead of a continuous variable that is native to normal?
In the easy model, you would, of course, project to a spin variable, yeah. So, but that would be not too difficult, I guess, say. So you only allow the degrees of freedom here to be spins, basically, of course, discrete spins. And then you find the properties of the filter that gives you, that goes from there to there, yeah. But it's definitely probabilistic. I mean, there's no... you know, there's strictly speaking no unique step, say. So it's the most likely step, say, or whatever you want to call it. Yeah.
Oh, is it then also probabilistic in the 5-2-4 model?
It is. Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah.
Just a, I don't know what, a philosophical question. You, so there's no critical slowing down, but some of the complexity of the calculation has gone into learning the, I guess, the inverse transformation. Is that kind of the trade-off?
No, you would think so, but not that much, because the learning is on kind of smallish lattices, and is local as well. So that doesn't just. Very hard to see how that scales with either the volume or how close to the critical point you are, really. So a priori, it's not clear whether there's any negative, you know, side effects to this, but I'm sure there are, but they're not obvious. Yeah.
Thanks.
Sorry, you might have. I mean, Sebastian might have already asked this question, but I didn't quite understand, because you said the critical beta is 0.44, if I'm not mistaken, 0.6, and the actual value in the Ising model was 0.4407 something. And so if you invert that, you would get 2.269. And what I didn't understand is, if you have the finite size scaling problem, so that if you're working with finite lattices, the number that you're neural net is going to approximate is not going to be 2.269. And if you get something that is exactly 2.269, is something here is something here is afoot. I don't understand.
Okay. The point is, indeed, on a finite system, your susceptibility, even your magnetic susceptibility, the peak of the magnetic susceptibility will not be at the infinite volume critical coupling or at the exact solution of the 2D Ising model. It will be a little bit smaller value of beta or larger value of T, say. And that's what this plot shows. So this, you can think of beta as 1 over T. So in your head, you can invert it to go to the 2.25 value. On a finite volume, the peak of the susceptibility are these points here. And so they actually lie significantly below the exact solution. So they're not exact in quotes, but the really exact solution. But that's where the peak is. Of course, the peak doesn't diverge either. The peak has a finite height. So that's also a feat of having a finite system. If you then take all these peak positions of the peak and you plot them versus the inverse linear volume, they are the symbols, the squares that lie here. And that what you can do then is fit this line to a finite volume in line, say type of this here. So the reduced temperature gives you the critical coupling in the infinite volume limit related to the critical coupling on a finite volume. And finite size scaling says that the difference between these two will scale with the volume with a critical exponent 1/nu. Yeah. What is computed is this quantity here, the critical coupling at a given system size. And by studying these values and plotting them against 1/L, with this particular power, that gives you access to the critical coupling then in the infinite volume limit. And so that's what this plot shows here. The line is a fit to the formula I just showed. And the extrapolation is then the critical coupling in the infinite volume limit. And so the prediction or the calculation that is given here is this black square, but it's not being computed on a lattice. We don't have a lattice with infinite volume, but it's extrapolated or it's fitted to the finite size scaling.
Oh, so this beta C that you that you're saying here is it's not the beta C that you had in your finite size lattices. This is what you got by using the critical exponent, by finding the critical exponent, like fitting it.
By simultaneously fitting the critical coupling and the critical exponent, the simultaneous fit to this equation here, using as input the critical coupling on a finite volume.
Yeah, I see. Okay, and I mean you might have already, and you probably explained this, but I missed this because there was kind of a chaos in the Bob room here in the Perimeter Institute. I couldn't hear it because I was moving. How did you find the critical exponent exactly?
That follows from the same fit.
Yeah, so because you can fit. Well, I mean, because you've. Right. Okay.
So yeah, you fit beta C at L versus L, 1/L, gives you access to both beta C at infinite volume and the 1/nu in this equation. So it's a curvature. So this is called finite size scaling, and you get very precise results in the infinite volume limit without doing simulations in the infinite volume limit, which would be quite hard, obviously.
That's very interesting. Thank you.
And I guess the point of this is that this is using quantities that come out of the neural network, not the magnetization or the magnetic susceptibility, which would be the standard parameters to use for this. Okay, in the last 10 minutes, I just want to give you a quick overview of some ideas we have, which are coming more from our, lattice field theory background, so to say, and which we give this kind of dubious title, quantum field theoretical machine learning. And really the idea is to develop some synergies between machine learning and lattice field theory, and just to see what it gets. And you can formalize this a little bit by saying that, many field theories are what mathematicians would call Markov random fields. And Markov random fields are used in machine learning algorithms a lot in a very general, it's a very general concept. And so there must be a way to close this circle and link back lattice field theories to machine learning algorithms. And hopefully not only by drawing this diagram, but also in some kind of constructive way to see what we can achieve. Now, this this relation between lattice field theories and Markov random fields is quite easy, so I'll skip this slide. But basically, it says if I have a probability distribution that lives on a lattice, say two-dimensional lattice, for instance, square lattice, and I can essentially write this probability distribution as a product of factors over smallest building block of the lattice, say, for instance, nearest neighbor's size, if I can do that and these functions are positive, then this distribution satisfies what's called the log of Markov property, and these fields are Markov random fields. And of course, many of our lattice field theories satisfy this, because if I have, a scalar theory with nearest neighbor interaction, then I can just factor my partition, my action. So I like to call it action because that's what we call it. I can factorize this probability distribution as a product over simple probability distributions over nearest neighbors only. If you discretize the kinetic term, you get a nearest neighbor coupling. And then in addition, you have local terms that live on the nodes. They what we call a mass term and a quartic coupling. And if I work out this product with the action S, I can see that I write it really as a product over all the nearest neighbors. And I factorize the potential term across each of those. And then the kinetic term connects the two nearest neighbors together. So this is just a very easy way to see that a scalar field theory is a Markov random field. And that, you know, potentially means that it's useful to use this language because this is a language that's used in machine learning as well. Now the theory, so we slightly generalized the standard lattice field theory here, because normally in a lattice field theory, this would be, this coefficient A would just be the mass parameter and would be just a constant. And the coupling B would just be, say, we would call lambda and would just be a constant. But here we've allowed for local dependence on these parameters. So the index A, the index I indicates that the say the mass parameter or the quartic coupling can vary from lattice point to lattice point. And that's of course something that's very common in machine learning architectures where these will be say biases that can depend from point to point. And in the same way, the nearest neighbor interaction, so it's written here as a kind of a Wij in the normal phi to the fourth theory, this would be like the hopping parameter kappa, which would be constant. But here we also allow it to be space dependent to have more flexibility. And then finally, of course, in a standard lattice theory, you would fix these parameters, this W, A, and B, and then generate configurations with e to the minus s as the weight. In machine learning, you, of course, do something different because you want to learn what these parameters are, say, from the input data. And so that's the first task, is to actually determine these variational parameters and then subsequently use this, say, to generate more configurations or more data samples once the parameters have been learned. And so from a QFT perspective, it's a slightly strange theory with all these local couplings, but it's not unheard of, so to say. There are, you know, models of QFT with random couplings or random potentials. So, and so I want to give in the last 5 minutes or so a very basic discussion of this, which at least it helps me a lot to understand it. Maybe for, you know, people working a lot in machine learning, it's all well known, but I find it useful for me, which is always a good reason to do something. And so the easiest example of a neural network or so is a restricted Boltzmann machine with what does the octopus mean, Sebastian? Just two layers, a hidden layer and a visible layer. And it's restricted, so only the nodes between the two layers talk to each other, but the nodes within one layer do not. And a standard restricted Boltzmann machine has spin degrees of freedom, living here, say 0 and 1, and is then with a very simple energy function that lives on these two layers, is then a so-called universal approximator. And so the standard restricted Boltzmann machine has essentially a bias on the visible node, a bias on the hidden nodes, and then a coupling between the nodes in the visible and the hidden layer, indicated with this essentially matrix W. And one can learn this distribution, learn these parameters W, B, and eta, eta from data using, say, contrastive divergence. And then after training, use it to generate more data examples. Now, of course, there's no need that these degrees of freedom should only be spins. They can also be continuous variables, so we can have scalar fields. And that then makes this connection with lattice field theory in a way. And so the aim is to see if we can use our knowledge of lattice field theory to further understand restricted Boltzmann machines. And for instance, you know, what distribution is actually learned? How is it encoded? The weight matrix, which connect the layers, what can we say about these? And are there any restrictions on the number of nodes that are allowed in either of the two layers, say? And so we do the simplest thing is what you do in field theory. You start with free fields, and this then leads to a Gaussian RBM. And it is, in a way, an interesting field theory because there are no couplings between the nodes in one layer. And so we only have potential terms living on each of the nodes in either the visible or the hidden layer, and then a coupling between the hidden and the visible layer, which is W. And so again, from a field theory, it's a kind of an interesting field theory. But of course, since it's Gaussian, you can integrate out, you can do whatever you want. Everything is exactly solvable, so to say. And so we can look at the distribution that's induced on the visible layer by integrating out the hidden layer. And this, of course, gives you a Gaussian distribution with a certain kinetic term and a certain source. And so what's interesting, if you think about this as a Gaussian field theory living on the visible layer, is that the kinetic term actually connects all to all. So after integrating out the hidden layer, it connects all nodes in the visible layer to each other, with this particular coupling matrix. And also that the bias in the hidden layer essentially acts as a source in the visible layer. And so, you know, at least, you know, as a field theorist, I can understand these terms and think about them. And then just by looking at these expressions, you can derive some very easy constraints on the parameters that appear in the RBM. So for instance, mu squared, the mass on the visible layer, is a parameter that can be learned. And the weight matrix is also a matrix that needs to be learned. And the kinetic operator on the visible layer is a combination of those. And so we'll show two slides with some constraints that emerge from this construction. For instance, this Gaussian integral should converge, which means that the eigenvalues of K should be positive. And that tells you then that this parameter mu squared has to satisfy this constraint. So that's one constraint that emerges. If we then use a scalar field as a target distribution, then we know a little bit more because we know this is essentially a positive definite matrix with only positive eigenvalues. And for instance, this tells us something then about the how the eigenvalues of this kinetic matrix that of the target distribution relate to, again, the mu squared parameter that needs to be learned. And similarly, then how the size of the weight matrix is in principle a rectangular matrix, but it tells us how the size of this matrix is related to essentially properties of the target distribution here. And in particular, if this kinetic operator of the target distribution is of the type I've shown here, it means that the weight matrix essentially has to be a square matrix. So this tells us something about the architecture, between quotes, namely that there should be as many hidden nodes as visible nodes in order to be able to satisfy these constraints and these relations between the target distribution and the parameters in the RBM. On the other hand, if you choose less, there should be a V, if the number of hidden nodes is less than the number of visible nodes, then the determinant on the left-hand side is zero. And that means that your target distribution will have eigenvalues that are equal to mu squared. So it's a constraint that your target distribution will then satisfy, basically. So this is a, if your choice is to do this, where the second H is a V, if this is your choice, then automatically this will be imposed on your target distribution. Let me skip a little bit. Let me talk about interactions, because that's quite interesting. So Gaussian RBNs are Gaussian, so you can only learn Gaussian distributions. There's not much more you can do. And so we need to include interactions in the language of lattice field theory. And there are various ways to actually add interactions. As a field theorist, I would add local potential terms on the node, so phi squared, phi to the fourth, and so on. But in the standard machine learning approach is actually to change the hidden layer, not to have continuous fields, but to have binary degrees of freedom. And these leads to completely different induced probability distributions on the visible layer. So if you introduce local terms here on the nodes, which is, you know, what I would do in my, from using my language, you essentially find these field theories with a phi to the four, phi to the six term, and so on and so forth, where all the kinetic operators are hidden in this matrix W, like before. So this essentially extends the previous analysis, but then with additional phi to the four and phi to the six terms. In the standard machine learning approach, you would actually take the hidden layer to have binary nodes, so plus or minus one. And in that case, if you integrate out the binary nodes, you get a kind of interesting field theory living on the visible layer. Namely, it has all couplings to all powers, and it also connects all nodes to all nodes. So it's a super non-renormalizable field theory, so to say, because it's all to all and all powers as well. And so, for instance, if you expand to lowest order, you get a quartic term where you have the five, you know, field, four five fields, but all the nodes are connected to all the other nodes via these weight matrices. And so it's an interesting question to think about this now as a, you know, as a lattice field theory and what it can do for lattice field theory. And the other case of having the local terms is interesting to think about what that can do for machine learning, because that's, they're very different properties. And Sebastian said I should show at least one example of this. So this is actually from the paper with Dimitros and Biagio. We actually tested this already in a, so this is a phi to the four RBM with two layers. Both layers have phi to the four interactions. And this is tested on this Olivetti set of faces. And if you look at the coupling matrices that connect the hidden layer and the visible layer, it has learned features of those faces imprinted in these matrices. So it has indeed learned something. And this is a, as I said, this is a phi to the four, phi to the four RBM. Okay, so let me stop here. So the hope here is that we can learn from lattice field theory to machine learning and vice versa. It's very much early days, I would say. So at least we derive, well, we derive some constraints on the parameters that are permissible in the RBM in order to satisfy some symmetries and some conditions and so on. And then interestingly, the interactions can be, from a field theory perspective, can be local or very highly non-local. So that's interesting to explore. Anyhow, I think it's an interesting, you know, interesting to explore these connections between problems that appear on both sides. And so we find new solutions to old problems, or maybe also can apply old solutions to new problems. So, okay, thanks.
Okay, now let's thank Gerrit for this very nice talk. Who has the first questions? Maybe until someone has a question, I might. So the octopus is from Game of Thrones, and it's related to RBMs. So RBMs are the kind of machine learning model that many physicists stumble upon because they're so closely related to physics. And at one point, no one used them anymore. So we had Isaac in our group who was working on RBMs, and he started this meme. So always when someone is, when RBMs are starting to show up, we do the "what is dead is does never die" meme.
I see.
The octopus. Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. No, they're very, at least they're very intuitive for a physicist. So that's great. Yeah.
Okay, so question.
I have a question. Sorry. So in the plots that you showed are the figures from the feature learning of images. It was cool that, you know, you get feature learning even if it's an under-parameterized model. And then if you go back, you said if the hidden units was greater than the number of visible units, then you have like what seems to me as a pretty restrictive constraint that like pops out of that. And I was curious if you could maybe talk more about what that means, because I think of like over-parameterizing your model gives you more power, but this seems like a pretty significant restriction.
Yeah, I would say this is still very much in progress with Chan Yu, my student who is here, to work out the implications of these quite simple constraints or relations. So it really depends on what kind of distribution you want to learn, I guess. So if we think about the scalar field theory language, then we want to learn a distribution where this is the kinetic matrix, and this definitely has all the eigenvalues positive. And so this particular, if you would use 0.4 here, you would never be able to learn the distribution exactly because you can't satisfy the conditions. The phases set in the end actually has NH less than NV. And so if you would look at this distribution in a little bit more detail and you would look at the quadratic term that appears there, you would find that there should be a whole bunch of eigenvalues there, which are just fixed by this constraint. The actual how well it learns and how badly it learns if you don't satisfy these constraints, we're still looking at, I would say. So this is more, at the moment, more theoretical, and the implications need to be worked out. Yeah.
Okay, so this 0.4, this should be number of hidden less than number of visible. Okay, so that would be under parameterized.
I see, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so that makes more sense than like in the under parameterized regime, you get some constraint on what you can learn. Okay, that clarifies things.
Okay.
Yeah, let me just echo. It's interesting because I think for 0.3, I would consider number of hidden equals number visible to be a lot of parameters. I think we've learned quite a few sort of interacting models at their critical points, basically with this. So I guess I'm surprised that that's necessary for a Gaussian model.
So for a Gaussian, where your target distribution is essentially n Gaussians, say. Yeah.
Yeah, okay, it's cool.
Can I also ask? Oh, wait.
Yeah.
Can I also ask about the discussion that we had last week, Gerrit? So about the accurate determination of phase transitions. I mean, we talked among ourselves and on the panel discussion, and for the others, the discussion was about using neural networks to predict the critical temperature more accurately than with other methods. And one of my opinions is that depending on, so if you change the lattice sizes, it might happen that your neural network does not learn the same observable. So, and this might have different effects then. So it might be that that the line that you use to fit your finite size effects might not be a line, or it could be that there are two observables that mix that have two different critical exponents, or it could be that there are additional effects from some domain boundaries that might not have a proper finite size scaling at all. I'm just speculating. So this is just my opinion in that sense. So it's not proven. But what it highlights is that there might be problems in more complicated systems. And if we do not know what the true critical temperature is, we might make errors. So what I have been thinking about in the last few days is how might we certify that a neural network that observables that are that a neural network finds when training on different lattice sizes might still follow this kind of finite size scaling?
Yeah. No, no, I know we discussed that. Yeah. So I wouldn't know the answer, actually. And I don't think when we did this analysis, it was encountered that there was like a, you know, mixing of operators. But yeah, it's a good point. But I would say definitely this kind of finite size scaling is essential to get precision. So without it, you don't get precision. Maybe with it, you also don't get precision. But without it, you definitely don't get the precision. And that's, yeah, I don't know what else to say here, indeed. So, I don't know what else to say. No, yeah.
Roger, do you have an opinion on that? I mean, you're also an expert on Monte Carlo stuff, so you might have encountered something like that too.
I didn't quite get it. What's the question?
Okay, so you use the neural network output as an observable, like the magnetization, when you evaluate the critical temperature. So when you do your finite size scaling, it might be that your neural network learns different things. So it could be for a smaller lattice, it learns some kind of observable, and for a larger lattice, it learns another observable. So it could be that there is that there are effects in the neural network that that prevent this finite size scaling from being a line.
Got it. So yeah, so I don't think it's, I mean, the rule of thumb, I think, is the neural network learns what's somehow easiest by some definition. I think the ferromagnetic like order parameter is the easiest thing here. But where what you're talking about does happen on like the XY model. So if you go to the O2 theory, what happens is you get a really, you know, even though in two dimensions, let's say O2 in two dimensions, there's no order parameter on the, you know, by the Merman-Wagner theorem. You know, still on a finite size system, there's quite an appreciable in-plane magnetization. So on small system sizes, the neural network does learn that magnetization. And so that can occur. I just think it's probably not a problem here.
But no, it's not a problem here. But if you go to more complicated systems where we do not know what is going on, when you have topological effects, where you have, so my standard example is SUN gate theory, where the Polyakov loop is an order parameter. The Polyakov loop, since is a loop that extends in time direction, it's a quantity that gets harder and harder to learn when you increase the lattice size by its nature, just since it extends the whole lattice. And
that makes sense too. But they are definitely in the O2 model in two dimensions. Look at that. That's another example. Sorry, go ahead.
I can also just add that, like, this is exactly what happened when we used the max independent set data. Like, it's got this like graph structure that was really hard to find, but it was just learning kind of the correct occupation number, which was easy to learn. But then, you know, your Hamiltonian is really sensitive to where those occupations are, and it just couldn't seem to figure that out. So I agree, Sebastian, but also agree that it just doesn't seem to be a problem here.
Well, the easing model has been analyzed so often that we know it so in so many different ways. But yeah, in general, this could comment and useful.
Yeah. I think also, yeah, similar to your point, Gert, like as we do scale up to like more complicated models, you learn more sophisticated tricks for forcing your models to learn something less trivial.
Sorry, I didn't understand the last point Scott made. What methods can you use? So if you have a complicated system like the SUN thing that Sebastian was talking about, and you assume that for small size lattices, you learn the Polyakov loop, but for bigger lattices, you might learn something else like the, let's say, Wilson action, then how could you, or it could learn something else that is also simpler. How could you this potentially distinguish this while making your architecture complicated? I might have gotten this wrong. I maybe Scott meant something else, but how can you, by making your architecture more complex, interpret what the neural network is learning?
So I'm not really thinking along adjusting the architecture or interpreting, but you know, you have some physical intuition about the system. So, and I don't know that much about the system you're talking about, but if you know that the system obeys certain symmetries, you can kind of enforce your model to learn those symmetries, and then it restricts the space, like the parameter space that you're searching. I was thinking more things like that.
Yeah, but restricting it to learning those parameters makes it supervised or semi-supervised. And maybe if you want to detect an order parameter, let's say even in the Ising model, you can't restrict it to, say, learn the magnetization, because that way, well, I mean, you expect it to learn magnetization, and I mean, you use something that you didn't want to use. Because in general, we might not know what the order parameter is, and we have some guesses. And if you force it to learn the particular parameter,
it's not really forcing it to learn a particular, like if you, given a Hamiltonian, you know, certain symmetries that will be obeyed by the ground state. So you're not forcing it to learn the magnetization, but you're forcing the properties of the ground state that it learns to like have certain symmetries.
I see what you mean. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
But I guess in general, the comment of Sebastian is that you always have to be able, you have to be able to verify or validate your results, basically. And
right.
Not always possible. If you know the answer, it's pretty possible. It's always possible to just compare with the answer you know. But it's
right.
Not the case in realistic cases. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thanks, Gert, for joining us. I know you've had a long day, but this was great.
No, thanks a lot for the invitation. I enjoyed it. Yeah.